What was the story with Madonna? Is it, what part is truth, or do you want to say?
There are a few little nuggets of truth sprinkled throughout the biopic. The only time I actually met her was in 1985. I talked to her for maybe like 45 seconds backstage. So that's the extent of the relationship.
And she's in the whole movie, but.
Oh, she's a huge part of the movie.
A 32 Fans podcast, where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester.
And I'm John Gilpatrick. Today, we are going to be talking about the movies of, I guess, both September and October 2022, right, Sammy?
Yeah, this is the first time in the, you know, 3+ years so far of the Will Be Pod that we liberally skipped a month. There's been months when we've had, you know, double or even triple or even quadruple when we were doing that sports movie Odyssey, where we've skipped a month. And I, for one, at least, John, and I know maybe you align with me a bit on this, I can say I skipped September partly because I was traveling most of September. And so, you know, scheduling was going to be a bit more difficult. I guess I was traveling most of October, the first half. So when we would have tried to meet to discuss September movies, I wasn't available.
Right.
But also, you know, looking over the releases of September and October, you know, there were a few names that if you would have asked me 10 months ago, I was a bit excited, like the Marilyn Monroe competition with Elvis, you know, biopic that came out and called Blonde. And, you know, we'll get into these maybe a bit more. And, you know, I think October actually had a bit more releases I was excited for than September. But on the whole, you know, I was happy just to say, let's hold off and just cover both months when we do, because these past 2 months to me, I mean, it's kind of indicative of this year, where this was a year in terms of movies so far for me where very few things are getting me excited and jazzed, where, and actually, and this is something, again, we've returned to this theme several times, which is fine that we have, because, you know, this this podcast is how enthusiastic we are to talk about new movies that have come out, and, you know, we should, therefore, our enthusiasm is fair to share, which is the beginning of the year, like, you know, I was excited. You had, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once had was this kind of, like, unique, really a unique kind of movie that came splashing down. And then you had, you know, the Batman movie, which was interesting. And then you had that Nick Cage movie, which had been delayed for 2 years and finally came out, which was, you know, better than it should have been, better than it had any right to be, frankly. And, you know, then there was, I'm forgetting the name of it now, but the Vikings movie, which was
Northman.
Yeah, Northman. You know, to me, it was kind of similar to Batman, where I had fun with it, even if I didn't love it. You know, you had the movie, I think, that we both kind of had a good time with, about the woman locked at home, sort of who's afraid to go out of her house. You know, obviously you had Tom Cruise, who had this like big splashy movie that was fun to see. You know, so the first half of the year was, you know, I would say,
Kimmy's
Kimmy's such a forgettable title. I have to say the worst part of the movie might be the title, which is saying something for it. So the first half of the year was probably, I would put head to head outside of it, didn't have any exciting foreign movies. I think foreign movies that you first half of the year, they had already come out from the COVID years, and then they were sort of on a pause, maybe more so than, but on the whole, like the first half of 2022 movie wise was quite impressive and quite fun. And there was reason to think, okay, you know, we have ourselves like an exciting year to talk movies. And then, I don't know, since like the Tom Cruise movie basically came, or maybe, I don't know, maybe we're speaking a bit of Blonde and maybe Weird Al today, but since like the Elvis biopic movie came out, which was, if I recall correctly, like the beginning of the summer, that seemed it could be fun. It had like Baz Luhrmann, a named director. It's around that time, there's been nothing that
I know
I've seen that's been exciting or memorable to watch. The only one that maybe comes to mind, and there's parts I didn't like about it, which I spoke about when Justin joined me, the stop action horror cartoon called God Something. That was just sort of memorable in how weird it is. But really, I mean, there's just nothing. If you had the same experience, John, is there a year that sort of comes to mind for you? It doesn't have to be a year per se, but where you had the same experience where like month after month, you sort of were like, is it me? Is it the movies? I think it also is a bit me. It's also my, it's my life. It's my, you know, new job. It's my relationship with my, you know, family members, my wife. Like certain things have been kind of distracting or demanding maybe a bit more of my attention than in years past. But I also think it's the movies.
I think it's both. I agree with you. I feel the same way. I don't remember another time period where I felt this way about movies where it was just totally ambivalent. I think part of that is the movies and part of that is, you know, me having other things to kind of preoccupy my time. And I mean, the only other possible comparison you'd have to bring up is 2020, but that was such an anomaly. In a way that this doesn't feel like it. Like I remember last year when we'd be on and every month it seemed like from the spring onward, it was sort of, all right, this is starting to feel normal again. Like this is going okay. Even if we didn't love everything, it was still felt more excited things to watch and talk about.
To catch up with.
And I would say, I'm glad you reminded me of like the beginning of the year, because there was stuff that we were excited to talk about and that I enjoyed. In my head, I thought, okay, like, this is just how it's going to be, especially heading into the summer, which is more of a high interest time for movies in general. It seemed like it dropped off a cliff after Top Gun came out and everybody just kept talking about Top Gun for 6 months. There are movies that like I'm excited to see. So like Tar came out in October. It's a movie that decided I really wanted to see on the big screen. Not that I know of any other specific options, but I'm sure that they might exist. It's not available to me, you know, where I live right now. There's other stuff coming. But even still, like, I'll look at the calendar and it's like, okay, I'll see that. Like, I guess I'll see that. Like, the big movies that everybody's, I think, you know, kind of talking about or is going to be talking about. But I can count on, like, one hand almost, like, what I'm super jazzed to see.
I had shared sometime in the beginning of the year, around March or so, what I call the 2022 watch list, where I had done, the number of professional movie pundits who come up toward the beginning of the year and say, you know, the movies to have on your calendar for this year. So I had kind of dropped those all down into sort of month by month. And I remember the last column was the don't know the release date. And that had like 50 movies. So actually just earlier today, I went through and I kind of removed those 50 movies to either reassign them to the month, which is mainly November, December, when they're supposed to come out, or in most cases, and this was a lot of kind of premier directors or, you know, movies that we'd otherwise be excited about, almost all of them there, to be fair, in January, they didn't really know when they were coming out. A lot of them have been pushed to 2023 or 2024. And they're not pushed like in 2020 when movies were being pushed because of Corona and theaters. Just in general, these are kind of like, you know, like Scorsese or other kind of, you know, big name directors whose movies, I guess, are just taking longer to work on or whatnot. So, you know, some of the titles that I would normally be like, oh, okay, they're still coming out in December or that like, as if they came out in 2022, but they're actually coming out the first few weeks of January, you know, for like Oscar noise. A lot of those were pushed and aren't really on the calendar. I mean, we don't have to get too far ahead. We do say in our intro that we also, you know, maybe talk about movies to come.
Occasionally, you know, feature. What?
Yeah. Look, Black Panther 2 is, I think, being released today as we record. So, you know, that's kind of a banner movie that might get some attention. I kind of like, you know, Black Panther 1 was a movie that I got kind of known for being critical of right before this podcast came into existence. You know, I think Black Panther now,
in retrospect,
I think it was fine. I never thought it was great. Black Panther 2, I have a sense of what it's going to kind of be, you know, because of obviously the unfortunate passing of the lead. So I think it's going to be fine. But, you know, MCU, we've spoken about in the past, you know, it's one of the reasons maybe this year has been underwhelming, but neither of us has been particularly impressed by MCU. So I'm not expecting anything from Black Panther. I won't see it in any kind of rapidity when it comes. Otherwise, you know, looking out on movies like that are coming out the rest of this month or next month, I've heard kind of some people say that movie that came out, I guess, formally this past week, The Banshees of Inisherin. So it came out kind of in early November. That's a movie I'm, you know, I want to see, but I can't tell you I'm like super excited to see. What else really? The Fablemans is coming out the end of November. You know, it's that kind of annoying genre now.
You know what I feel about this.
Yeah. So there's actually two of those this month. Armageddon Time is James Gray's kind of version of that, which I've heard kind of very You know, it's a November movie, so maybe we'll speak about it next month. But if The Fabelmans, the Spielberg take on that, so a bit more prominent director. But, you know, neither of those, I would say I'm so excited, because even though I liked Roma and the one we got last year about Belfast, I guess. Yeah. You know, still, I do think the kind of the genre doesn't do it for me too much. The kind of the overly precocious, as you said, the overly precocious youngster with the sort of magical grandpa, you know, is like his troubled childhood. Roma, actually, I was thinking about that today. Roma, maybe one of the reasons it was a bit better is, like, Roma, as I recall, it didn't really focus on the child. It was actually more like, you know, Cuarón, the director's thinking through like how his parents or his society's experience was, as opposed to, you know, with like Belfast and Armageddon Time I've heard about and Fablemans I've heard about. It's very, very much that kind of like, you know, as I said, very precocious young boy who's kind of the future artist and, you know, looking at how magical his family and how troubled his lifestyle, his society is around him. So I don't know. Like, I'm not as critical as you are of those, but they don't get me too excited. December, I don't know. I mean, what in December or maybe late November excites you? White Noise by Bomba.
I'm excited for Avatar.
No, that's definitely fair. Yeah, so yeah, I would say Avatar is kind of the December version of Black Panther. Comes out around the same time.
Yeah.
I was mild on the first one, but I'd be go and see the second one.
Just curious. Like, for me, that's like, I don't know that I'll love it. I might be totally kind of lukewarm. I might hate it. Like, I have no idea. I'm just so curious about it in a way that, like, I'm also, like, curious about Black Panther, but I also kind of know what I'm going to get. More petered out on the MCU than I am on, like, whatever the ACU is, Avatar Cinematic Universe. So that one is just like a big mystery, and I'm like, yeah, okay, like, that's cool. I'm excited to see, like, whatever that is going to be.
Yeah, you know, both movies, I'm sure people were speaking about this, and both movies have like a very heavy, the bad guys in Black Panther 2, this isn't a spoiler, it's in all the, you know, it's in all the previews, trailers and screens. The bad guys in Black Panther 2 is effectively, it's like the underwater men. It's like the guy from the DC movies. So it's just like the MCU version of that. So it's just funny. Yeah. It's a shame that it just, like, you know, get the same actor just to kind of take the role. But anyways, and then obviously Avatar, everyone's been talking about it, how like they're underwater this time. So I don't know if that means the bad guys are underwater or just the good guys are now have fins and scales. But so there's definitely like an underwater theme across both of those kind of temples. Knives Out 2 is coming out in December. And to me, Knives Out 2 is kind of like your description of Avatar 2, which is, you know, I'm curious to see it. I thought the first one was fun. I never understood people who said it was the best movie of 2019.
No, it's been a while. Yeah.
I thought the first one was fun and nice, and I appreciated, you know, being original content, so to speak, even though it felt to me kind of rehashed, like it felt like an Agatha Christie mix-up. But, you know,
it was just kind of like harmless entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. That was how I felt about it.
You know.
I don't know. Otherwise, I mean, Babylon, I think, is supposed to come out at the very end of December, and that has, like, all the actors who weren't in enough movies over the course of the year. You know, as I said, Baumbach has a movie coming out at the beginning of December, White Noise, which is based on a book that I read years ago. You know, it has the regular Adam Driver, who seems to be his go-to guy. You know, I don't know. There's just like nothing that kind of gets me extra excited. Especially, you know, I was kind of it's something we don't necessarily talk about until it lands in our pocket. But when I think of kind of putting together a 32 bracket sometime, you know, in March of 2023, and we try to hash out who should go through the bracket to win best movie of the year.
Certainly right now, I wouldn't be able to pick 32 movies that deserve to be in that. I mean, you know, normally all 32 are movies that you or I especially liked. You know, usually it's like a movie, it's a bracket of champions. And I don't know how many movies you've seen so far this year, John.
I have only seen 20 that I would like recommend and I'm fond of. And then I've seen four. Oh wow, I've seen an even 40. So I've seen 20 that I disliked and 20 that I liked. And you know, will I be able to add 12 more to make it to 32? Obviously, some, you know, we can include that you particularly like and I'm down on. I hope there's at least 32 that we think are worthwhile, you know, of whatsoever. You know, I mean, every one of the 64 teams in March Madness has a fair belief that it could win the entire tournament, right? So you don't put you don't put basketball teams in March Madness that don't believe they have any chance of winning it. So I don't think we should do the same. If we need to reduce, you know, the movie bracket to a solid 12 this year, we could do so, I guess.
I guess so, yeah.
How many of the movies you've seen this year would you say are in your recommend, your fond of pile?
Recommend, you know, I tend to be a little bit more kind of like forgiving on that, on that scale. Like, as long as I didn't hate it, I'm like, yeah, if you're excited about that, then go watch it. Yeah, that's kind of what I tend to tell people. But I would say, like, I would give a fresh tomato if I was so privileged to, I don't know, maybe 12 movies.
That's like half the movies you've seen, or even two thirds, maybe.
Yeah, probably about half. I think I'm probably around 25, if I had to guess.
Okay, so
but maybe this bleeds well into kind of some of the specific titles from September and October. But like, I started to watch a bunch of things and just stopped because I was just like, I don't care about this story anymore. And I never used to do that. It's like if I started something, I felt this obligation to finish it and add it to my kind of tally. And like, I would say just really over the past few months, I've kind of like, eh. Like, there's plenty of other stuff for me to watch or do, and I'm just not going to, like, force myself to sit through 90 more minutes of something that I don't care about.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought about that because I've been having somewhat of that same attitude. And
yeah,
to my mind, it's kind of a balance where you have to kind of just be honest with yourself and say, is there any element of, you know, 21st century shortened attention spans, not giving enough, like, patience to a work of art and letting it breathe? Or is it simply that, you know, the work really doesn't deserve it? And, you know, and even in the 21st century, if a work deserves it, it needs to stand on its own feet, you know, it needs to sort of engage you. And you know, can't just fall back on like, oh, like I have to sit here and, you know, this and give 2 hours to let the professor explain why this piece of art is so sophisticated. Like, no, like at a certain point, if it can't get you in the first chapter, then you can put down the book and never go back to it. So that, I try to kind of maintain that balance, but I'm with you. I mean, yeah, let's dive in. You know, what are some of the movies that didn't grab you as you had hoped they would?
I think, you know, ended up not recording last month for a few reasons, including your travel. But another reason was, I think the most high profile maybe release of September was going to be Blonde, which was this kind of long awaited biopic, I guess, of sorts of Marilyn Monroe. And I was looking forward to it for a while, I felt like, because the director is Andrew Dominik. He made Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which is a movie I loved. And then his follow-up was Killing Them Softly, I think it was called, which I also liked. And it's been 10 years since that movie came out, and he's been working on Blonde in the meantime. And there just seemed like there was a lot of buzz for this movie for a while. Then it premiered at like some of the festivals, and like I feel like it got a kind of a muted response, and some people were like, it's a little much. And I felt like it kind of dampened my expectations, but it's still like, okay, like this is coming out on Netflix, I'm kind of curious. And then like it hit, and I just like started to read people's like real people's responses, I think. And it was just like, this is not interesting or fun or anything. And I was like, well, I guess I'm going to still watch it. And I started to, and I was just like, yeah, this really just isn't fun at all. Not that all movies have to be fun either, but like, I'm just like, what am I gaining from watching this? And I felt like the answer was nothing.
So to the extent that if the reviews would have been more hyped, you think you would have given it a bit more time. You would have kind of allowed it a bit more. But the fact that it didn't work for you,
I think
that it wasn't very good to begin with.
I think if it was a different movie, then the reviews would have done that. Like, you know, it all kind of like goes hand in hand, where it's like, yeah, maybe the reviews did dampen my expectations, and I was more willing to kind of give up on it than I would have been otherwise. But, you know, for me to not have done that, like it needed to just be a better, more like engaging movie instead of being so kind of obtuse and I found it just like kind of irrelevant. Like, I don't really know what the point being trying to be made was. I mean, and I think that you had kind of given it a similar chance, if I remember
from our conversation. It was the one, I saw some, you know, old timey movies, but it was the one classics corner, but it was the one new release that I did make time to see while I was traveling in early October. And my impression, so I tried to, you know, it was on Netflix. So it was on Netflix. I imagine Netflix will get rid of it fairly soon because they've just seen the response. But I just felt, I made three goes at seeing it. I had downloaded it to my phone off Netflix, so it was very accessible as I traveled around. And I think I tried three times to kind of each time continue watching it. And I got, you know, maybe halfway through, maybe two thirds, but I definitely didn't get to whatever the Big Bang ending might be. I just felt that it failed to capture any of the brilliance of Marilyn Monroe, who, for whatever reasons, and I don't pretend to be any expert on Marilyn Monroe, she is one.
Yeah,
of the most
nor am I.
She's one of the most fascinating pop culture figures. I mean, again, it's kind of funny that this and Elvis came out in the same year. Where
I know
the Elvis movie, as much as I didn't like it, I do think it sort of captured a certain, wow, that guy was like a one in a million. He was really brilliant. He had this sort of mixture of charisma and a moment in American history and everything that was really special. And it's funny also because the Elvis movie puts a lot of focus on his sex appeal, which was part of Elvis's appeal. And Blonde, I felt that that's kind of its mistake, where it reduces the entire charisma of Marilyn Monroe to her like physical sexiness, which again, like, that is a major element of like who she was and what that, but it doesn't give you that sense of like context, like, oh, in the same way that like Elvis's hips were like changing American preteen women or like girls and like, you know, changing social norms, they don't give you any context for that with Blonde. Blonde is just like, oh, she's like a basically like a bimbo that like guys salivate over, and that's kind of all the movie has to say. It's just like, hey, dudes are like, you know, guys are, you know, sexual idiot dudes, and they like salivating over like a blonde who raises her skirt when, you know, when the wind comes or whatnot, or like has big boobs. Like, it just Blonde, just like, I feel bad for like Marilyn Monroe because it kind of just reduces someone who was also a great actress. Like, she's a really great actor. She's funny. And this movie is basically like she had daddy issues, and, you know, guys just love to salivate over her. And I didn't think the actress is particularly great in Blonde. You know, I think she's limited by the material. They kind of ask her to be like a one bit, like, you know, calling all the men in her life daddy. And that just, again, it might be real to life that Marilyn Monroe called Joe DiMaggio and her other husbands and boyfriends daddy.
Arthur Miller.
But like, Arthur Miller. But like, I don't know, just the way it came across, where she's like just wandering after, forget the name of the actor playing Arthur Miller, the guy from The Piano. But, you know, the way she's kind of
Adrian Brody.
The way she's wandering after Brody, and then Joe DiMaggio, the actor, just being like, daddy, daddy. I don't know. I was just, it just didn't capture anything for me. And, you know, again, I kept on kind of comparing my head to Elvis, which came out earlier this year. I don't know if you had a chance yet to catch up with Elvis, where that. You know,
yeah, I did. That's, yeah.
That movie has like a distinct style that is a little bit complex, and it has elements to it, you know, even just the way that it shows Colonel Mustard or whatever his name is and Blonde just had nothing for me. So yeah, that was a wise skip on your part. I think you can put that into your list of movies you've seen and put it toward the bottom where it deserves.
Okay, fair enough. I would say, so I did see Elvis, and it was like one of those movies that I would, you know, probably if somebody asked me, like, oh, did you see Elvis? I'd be like, yeah, I saw it. Like, you know, you should check it out if you're interested. Like,
yeah,
wasn't like something I loved, but I understand why people were into it, and like would tell people, like, yeah, you can watch that. It's fine. I would not say that about Blonde. But it's kind of funny to talk about those two in comparison to each other, I think, because like, the director of Elvis was Baz Luhrmann. And if you told me that like one of these two guys was going to make a biopic that was like all style and no substance, I would have assumed it was Baz Luhrmann, because a lot of his other movies kind of fall into that trap. But I felt like Elvis was a little bit more conventional. And Blonde is just this like, yeah, like you said, just kind of very one note, like everything is one note, from the characters and perspective and story and acting and everything. And it's just like an excuse for this guy to kind of do a lot of like weird camera shit and editing.
Yeah, but the camera shit is like, not even, it's not even fun. It's like the, I don't know. Like,
that's what I mean. Well, it's all style. There's nothing to it that like, that makes it worth doing.
Yeah, but I'll give you an example. It's obviously, it's kind of funny to describe this. Decision to Leave, that Korean movie by, I apologize for getting his name as well, though I guess I have a bit of a pass because it's a very foreign language. It's a Korean, but he's the director of, all those kind of violent Korean movies that people really love. And so I caught up with it at the festival a few months back. It came out in the theaters formally in early October. So maybe, Decision to Leave is kind of on the map for this month. We'll wait to discuss that until we both had a chance to chew through it a bit more. Decision to Leave has style to burn. I mean, it's like, that's a movie I would tell people who really are like cinema style lovers. Like, that's a movie to watch just for the style. And the style is like so impressive. You're like, wow, this director like knows what he's doing. And then the plot and the story there and the acting, frankly, are a little ho-hum from my perspective. And it's why the movie to me is, as you kind of described Elvis, I would say Decision to Leave is kind of like, okay. But the style there is like, wow. As opposed to the style in Blonde is sort of just like, oh, he's playing around with he's not playing around in a fun way. It's just like, oh, like has like a drone shot on someone's head, or he's like falling into someone's innards and their kidneys. I don't know. Blonde, we spent way too much time on it. Yeah, way too much time on it. What are some other ones? What are some other ones that you cut and run from wisely so far? Or something you really liked, no reason for us to both dwell in this like land.
I don't really have anything that I would say I liked. I know there's one thing that we both watched in its entirety, which is maybe a novel for this year, this moment. Mm-hmm. And that was Wendell and Wild, which is a fairly kind of high profile new animated film. That starred, among others, Key and Peele, and was directed by Henry Selick, who last made a movie, speaking of long waits, in I think 2009 or 8 with Coraline. Mm-hmm. So he does like the stop motion animation stuff. He also directed The Nightmare Before Christmas, probably his most well known movie.
James and the Giant Peach.
And also James and the Giant Peach, yeah. So this is his new thing. It was on Netflix, I think, right?
Yeah, it came out on Netflix like a week or so ago in real time when we're recording. Jordan Peele not only joined with his former comedy buddy Keegan to voice two of the cartoon characters in it, Wendell and Wild, who are actually side characters, but they get the name. But Jordan Peele also wrote this movie, so he was fairly involved.
Yeah.
And I think that's I'm more underwhelmed than you. I mean, to me, I would say if you're going to see a movie with Key and Peele, where they're cartoons, go see Toy Story 4, because I think Toy Story 4 captures their wit that I've said this many times on the podcast, but I absolutely love Key and Peele, the comedy sketch. And I felt Get Out was this like perfect encapsulation of like so much that's good in their comedy sketch, like the wit and the horror and the racial comment that Key and Peele's sketches managed to put into a movie. And Us had some of that, but not as much. Get Out had that to the T. Nope, a little bit of that, but that's really, I think, Jordan Peele maturing as a director, meaning just kind of doing his own thing, less his sketches. Toy Story 4, all the scenes kind of with Key and Peele, as I forget who they were, but the two little cartoons that they are in that movie, boom, like that is a Key and Peele sketch. That their lines are great. They have such great chemistry. And I guess give credit to Pixar as opposed to Jordan Peele as a writer. And I was gonna get into this with you. I really didn't like Wendell and Wild. I was pretty excited for it. I really didn't like it. I could have stopped in the middle, but I did kind of sit through. It's on Netflix. I think that when Jordan Peele writes a movie and puts him and Keegan both into it, and the only other, I guess, example of this is 2016's this cat movie Quanta.
The cat movie.
Yeah.
So Keanu?
I think that's what it's called. Yeah.
It was Keanu. Yeah.
Yeah. So Wendell and Wild and Keanu were both the movies that were written by Jordan Peele and that both him and Keegan play very prominent roles in. Both of those I find underwhelming. But not only that, both of those I find like don't have the wit of their sketch comedy. And I mean, this one in particular, I just felt like him and Keegan, their lines were poor, their dialogue, their kind of
back and forth was boring. Their banter, and you know, that's what's so good in their sketch comedy. That's what's so good. I mean, Jordan Peele wrote Get Out, Us, and Nope, and their sketches. Like, he clearly is a good writer. And yeah. I just felt Wendell and Wilde, the writing and the kind of banter, therefore, for the characters. A lot of talented voice actors in Wendell and Wilde, but like, I just felt it was very dry. I mean, the reason to watch Wendell and Wilde would be the Henry Selleckness of it all. I love James and the Giant Peach from my childhood. Like, yeah. The Henry Selleck design of it is fun, but the plot is as kind of carbon cut as they come. Like, it just feels like a kind of a 90s Disney movie in terms of like the way the story is going. And I thought the script I thought was just so bland. So it was a miss for me.
Yeah, I wasn't as low on it as you were, but it definitely didn't like quite live up to my expectations going in, which were pretty high. I thought that I agree, like, that the animation itself was like really fun, and I'm kind of a sucker for that like style, because I think we see it so infrequently, and sort of the more CGI or however you were, like, computer animated movies, like, you know, they're more familiar at this point than stop motion or hand drawn. So like, whenever somebody's going to do something like that, I kind of get psyched. So with that said, I felt like just the story, like, yeah, didn't really like have a ton going on that was interesting. I felt like it was like really overstuffed with plot and like kind of points that it needed to hit to get from like one place to another, and like maybe almost too many characters. So it ended up just feeling like there wasn't enough time to kind of like revel in the world that they created, which was sort of like, in theory, fun and interesting. And you just didn't really get, like, I feel like all the, you didn't ring it for everything it was worth, because you just had to spend so much time kind of enveloping the story, wasn't that interesting.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So it's interesting. You know, I spoke at the beginning, I kind of only said half the name. Mad God is that really memorable, kind of horrific stop motion. And there was Marcel the Shell with Shoes On.
Oh, right, yeah.
I guess like stop motion-y, it's stop motion as well. And now we have Wendell and Wilde. So it is a year for stop motion, even if, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of the quality of it. I'm surprised, because again, there's a lot of things I really can't stand. They're just like things that disgusted me with Mad God, is like a lot to handle. But Mad God is of all the stop motion so far, Mad God is my favorite of the year. But maybe we'll have a stop motion playing sometime end of the year, because there's a number of them. Let me give you a few, John, quickly that I didn't like, and then we can maybe, you know, end on a bit more of a positive note. This is something I have to kind of share, because again, I was overly maybe excited for it. Sometime in mid-September, there's a movie that came out called Medieval. Medieval had quite a cast. I was thinking in my head it was kind of like the Warcraft renewal, because the Warcraft movie came out a few years ago and it really wasn't very good. And it had Ben Foster in it, though. It was like very not good, the Warcraft movie. And it had Ben Foster, though, who's an actor who I really like. I find like Ben Foster can bring it when he wants. And so Medieval came out, it had Ben Foster, it had Michael Caine, you know, a few kind of actors from Hollywood you've heard of, you know, playing some of the more minor roles. And what it is it was going to be, as it suggests, because it's called Medieval, the title is as bland as the movie. So the movie is a complete pass. I don't recommend anyone to watch it. But Ben Foster plays Jan Ziska, who was a real life, like 1300s Shizek kind of warlord and icon, who was incredibly fascinating. I mean, go read the Wikipedia article about him when you have a chance, Jan Ziska. But he basically kind of invented how the cannon is used. This is like right when cannons were being developed. So he was the one who kind of invented how you could use cannons on open battles. Like, before him, cannons were only used because they were huge and lumbering in siege warfare against castles. And he kind of he basically designed this kind of new form of artillery that could be used and pushed around by peasants. And then what he's kind of known for is he led a series over. I mean, he lived fairly long, given that, you know, he was usually fighting on the smaller side. He led a series of basically peasant rebellions against the Holy Roman Emperor. So he was almost always fighting, you know, with the side that was less trained and had less people, etc. And I think they say, like, he never lost a battle in his life. He also, another thing, I'm kind of skipping the lead here, he was also blind, because he lost his vision early on
in his fighting life. And so he also was blind. And despite the fact that he was blind, and, you know, you think being not being able to see in the Middle Ages would severely limit your tactical capabilities on an open battlefield. Despite, I think he lost one eye and then he lost the second eye in a later battle. Like, he lost his eyes by fighting. Despite the fact that he was blind, he basically never lost a battle over like 40 years of relentless warfare. So super interesting guy. What does this movie choose to do, John? And this is why I have to complain about it. So the Ben Foster is really great. And he's obviously cast as Jan Ziska. And then Michael Caine is playing some old advisor, obviously, and blah, blah, blah. What does this movie choose to do? This movie chooses to portray Jan Ziska in the period before he became famous and before he fought his first famous battle, before he took up the cause of the peasants, before he lost his vision. Meaning, this is doing what sometimes, you know, movies will do, which is like, this is the 10 years before you knew him. You know, remember, like, there's the Indian movie that came out earlier this year, RRR, and the kind of conceit of RRR is that here are these two real-life famous Indian revolutionary figures, and we're showing you a period before they were famous, when they might have known each other, and how they kind of, how their fervor for rebellion was born. That's kind of, you know, the theme of RRR. And sometimes Hollywood likes doing that, where they like showing us, like, before they were famous, this is sort of what gave them their drive to, you know, go on to become historical figures. And so that's what this movie chooses to do. But as a result, we just get a completely bland, forgettable story where there's absolutely nothing to recommend this. Nothing. And yeah, I was just shocked at how bland this movie was. And so, yeah, I've spoken enough about Medieval more than anyone should give it any passing attention. I'll give you two movies that are fairly prominent that I was very underwhelmed by. One is Triangle of Sadness. It came out in theaters, you know, I think sometime in October. This movie, do you know anything about it? Do you sort of know?
Well, I know it won the, like, Cannes, like, Film Festival Top Award, and I like know kind of a general outline of the plot, but you know, not too much other like detail.
Well, you're familiar with the director Ruben Ostlander's some of his previous movies.
Yeah, so, the Force Majeure.
Yeah, so the original Force Majeure, I guess the Danish.
Right.
Yeah, any of his other kind of previous movies you'd seen, or did you see The Square?
I never saw The Square. No, I missed that.
Yeah. Yeah, this one is more familiar. This is much more familiar to The Square in terms of kind of lampooning the spoiled rich. But I thought The Square was more fun and takes more choices. I did not like Triangle of Sadness. I don't recommend anyone see it. It's very one note. And, you know, you could maybe describe it just as well as I can in terms of, so I saw the movie. I mean, what it is about a bunch of like super rich and the kind of protagonists are these two social media influencers. So much of super rich are on a boat, a cruise ship, and the movie sort of lampoons how spoiled and rich they are, and how, you know, it's a class criticism movie. So the movie is commenting on how rich they are, and the boat, they don't really explain it in the movie. It's not important, but basically the boat just like stops working. So then they're all stuck on a small little tropical island waiting to be saved. And then it's like, it's the poor, most of them don't make it off the boat, suffice to say, but that we don't care. Like, that doesn't matter to you as a viewer. And so the dozen people who make it to the island alive, those who are from the lower class are like effective, and they can do their whole survivor, like, you know, hunt for fish and, you know, just what you do if you're on the Survivor TV show. And then the other ones just basically lay on the sand, the rich ones, and expect to be served. And, you know, that doesn't really go very well for them, as you can imagine. The movie is like 2 hours, is way too long. It really just has one thing to say, which is that rich people are spoiled and like don't really deserve to like have their space in society. It's the kind of movie you'll forget the moment it's finished. There's really nothing to recommend it. So Triangle of Sadness has a fun name, but the name, do you know what the name is about? I think in the trailer they tell you why it's called Triangle of Sadness.
I don't know that now. I don't think I watched the trailer.
Okay, so the one thing to recommend it is maybe just the name of the movie, which apparently the Triangle of Sadness is between your eyes above your nose. When you're sort of, if you have just like a default face, what the kids these days call like a resting bitch face, if you have just like a resting face or whatnot, you'll kind of get there's like a natural wrinkle there that forms. So there's a way to like calm your face and not necessarily smile, but there's a way to basically, if your face has kind of a positive energy, that kind of wrinkle will go away. But if you have kind of a resting face and you're feeling down, then you have sort of a triangle, a wrinkle or something that forms there. So in the very, very beginning of the movie, and it's in the trailer, one of the protagonists is a model, and some kind of rich person looks at him and says, like, can you take away the triangle of sadness from above your nose? And that's supposed to, I guess, represent as a metaphor something or other. But
I thought that was mildly interesting to know what the title means. Otherwise,
yeah, that is funny, actually.
You've learned the title, and now you can Wikipedia the title, or you can obviously hopefully skip the movie. Not a con number one. And then the other one is, this is the movie at Cannes that people were most excited by. This is the movie, at least what I've read, that people said, oh, this was the most special movie to come out of Cannes. And this movie also came out this past month. It's available on, you know, here and there on streaming. I'm not really sure who released it. The name of the movie is After Sun. Now, had you heard of After Sun?
I have.
Are you excited for it? Because I'm about to like rain on that parade then.
I wouldn't say that I'm like so excited for it. It was just sort of one of these movies that like I heard people were, you know, kind of enjoying it, I guess, or whatever, or like finding something worthwhile in it. And
I'd heard people were raving about it.
Yeah, nothing like that sort of popped for me. I was just kind of like, okay, like whatever. There's like an actor who's buzzy who I don't really know from anything, but
yeah,
director I'm unfamiliar with, a premise that seems kind of like I've seen before. So I wasn't really sure what there was to be so excited about there. But yeah, maybe my read was right.
So I think your read is exactly right, which is that it does sort of feel like a movie you've sort of seen before. There's nothing particularly memorable about the movie. There's nothing it does new. It's a movie that I would say most people should pass if you're like a film literate who wants to kind of be in with the, you know, the film pundits, then you could see it. It's not a terrible movie. It's just like not particularly interesting. It's the kind of movie you would associate with Cannes. So what it is, it's about a divorced British dad in his 30s and his preteen, his like 10-year-old daughter, who go hang out at a rundown resort and they try to bond. And the dad is like kind of very detached and unsure of himself. And the daughter is basically what you would expect, like a 10-year-old daughter. She's nice. She's sweet. She's not mean.
Sure.
But she's kind of just like an average. She's very, very average. And nothing happens. They just kind of hang out at the resort. They do like a bunch of boring, bland, like rundown resort kind of like type activities. They go swimming. There's a lot of scenes of them swimming. The pacing is very slow. Nothing particularly happens. Now, the conceit of the movie, which is, you know, you're supposed to get it. I didn't really get it, which is maybe one of the reasons that, you know, I didn't appreciate the movie enough. The conceit of the movie is that I kind of got it. I just thought like the conceit of the movie was setting us up for some like tragedy to happen, and no tragedy, nothing ever happens. Nothing happens in this movie. Is that the conceit of the movie is that the 30-year-old version, grown up adult version of the daughter, is these are her memories of that summer with daddy. And so, you know, she's the age of her father kind of remembering. And again, they tell you this from the very first scene, because there's a lot of the movies shown as like camcorder recordings of her and her dad on vacation, and then they kind of now and then will kind of like jump back almost and show you like the adult who's kind of like playing with the camcorder or watching those clips, meaning the adult daughter. But when they do jump back to her, it's done very quickly in like a very kind of artsy style, and so I actually didn't completely get what was going on. I got that there was some, you know, older woman, but I thought the old woman actually was the wife. I thought it was the mom back at home. I didn't really connect that it was the daughter. And so the reviews I've seen that are raving about the movie, I waited to see the reviews until after I'd seen it. So I went completely unspoiled, which this really doesn't matter. Like, to use the word spoiler here is even like unnecessary. What the reviews all love about the movie, John, and this is, I think, something why it's like it plays to critics, is that they love how it's like, oh, this is showing how one's memories of their childhood with their parents are being reflected years later, because now years later the daughter is herself a parent and she's the same age that her father was, and now she kind of thinks back to that summer with dad and she remembers it differently than maybe she appreciated at the time. And all of those themes, I can, you know, so it basically plays with memory and how do we remember things. All of those themes sound great for like an artsy critic and maybe an artsy movie to dive into, but given I didn't get that concept enough from watching it, I just sort of watched a very bland, uninspiring movie that didn't really do anything to recommend itself to me. And on an emotional level, maybe because I didn't get enough what was going on in terms of this is all the memories of someone years later, nothing got me emotionally whatsoever. I mean, you can find things online that say this is the movie that you'll definitely cry watching this movie, or this is a movie that will move you, or this is a movie whose final shot is so emotional. And that I had seen a title like that before I saw it. So I went in being like, okay, at least there'll be a great. So I was watching the movie very bored. And I was like, okay, there'll be a great final shot that will get me. And then the movie ended. And I was like, wait a second, what happened to the final shot that was supposed to really move me? I know. And I at least had no final. I mean, to me, the final shot is just, it's literally a shot we saw earlier. It just kind of, I don't know, very underwhelming. I won't, say what it is, but it's like nothing to be too excited about, suffice to say. So what I would kind of put this as is there's a movie that came out last year called, or I guess formerly the beginning of this year for most people, Petit Maman. The movie by the French director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And yeah. Petite Maman is kind of really the same conceit, which is, in Petite Maman, Petite Maman is a more fantastical and it's much more beautiful movie to watch because it's in the forest and whatnot. Where Petite Maman is the idea that like a 10-year-old girl is meeting a 10-year-old version of her mother who somehow has been like taken back in time. And so her and her like mother as a child are like hanging out as children. And therefore she's kind of coming to terms with memories of her mother in a way that otherwise this 10-year-old doesn't appreciate of her parent. And so that's kind of the same, I would say, emotional / message that this movie is going for, except I didn't really particularly like Petite Maman, even though it worked for me a bit more. And some of the scenes there are just pretty, like when they're rowing on a boat or when they're playing in the forest. And none of the scenes in this movie I felt were like pretty to look at or memorable or interesting. I don't know. I would skip After Sun for pretty much everyone. And I don't get what any of the love is. So that was a movie I was hoping to, I went in, just mildly expectations and came out as a strong recommend against. But let me give you three that I did particularly like. And one is even a bit of a cheat because I guess it came out the first few days in November. Sounds
That's
good?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll do them in order. Sometime in the beginning of September, a movie came out with John Hamm called Confess Fletch. Now, Confess Fletch is apparently the third movie about this character, Fletch. I guess Fletch, I would say, is like something like a Hardy Boys. He's kind of he's an adult version of the Hardy Boys, meaning there's a series of books about him that came out sometime in the 20th century. He's kind of this man about town, lighthearted, investigative reporter type who kind of casually figures out mysteries with a lot of like a light touch, almost like a Curb Your Enthusiasm style humor. It's John Hamm. Doing the John Hamm we see in Curb Your Enthusiasm, meaning it's not Mad Men John Hamm. It's like a lighthearted, jokey John Hamm. And I really like that kind of John Hamm charisma. And that's the only reason you should see this movie. It's like an all-shucks murder mystery art theft story. And there's no actually funny jokes. It's a comedy. I didn't find a single joke in the movie was actually funny. And yet the kind of vibe of just we get to follow around with John Hamm as he kind of shucks it up, with various kind of minor characters. It was a winning formula for me. So it's a very mid movie. But if you go for John Hamm, then it's a must watch. Must watch. It's a mild watch if you really like John Hamm. And for everyone else, it's like a put on at work, and don't pay so much attention to. So that's Confess Fletch. I don't know if I put that on your watch list so far, John, or not.
It's just, I don't have a connection to the Fletch world.
I had zero. I had absolutely no connection to the Fletch world.
I didn't know there was a Fletch world. You don't have any connection to the Fletch world at all.
That's something I'll probably watch then.
Yeah. Which is, I wonder whether the movie clearly, John Hammer, the director, grew up on the Chevy Chase Fletch movies that I think came out in the 70s, the 80s. Because the first kind of 20 minutes of the movie, I think to Fletch fans, who I don't know if there are such thing as Fletch fans, but, they don't really introduce really who this guy is. They just kind of take it for granted that people in his world all sort of respect him as this kind of guy who doesn't really try very hard, but kind of just rambles through life kind of. And he has money and he's like, he used to be a reporter. He used to have a job. Like there's kind of a running gag where people keep asking John Hamm, what does he do? And he's like, oh, well, nothing really. I used to work, but now I sort of just like,
travel around and do stuff. And so I think that's kind of maybe playing off the Fletchness of it all, though, you know, if we know the character. But I had no idea. I wouldn't watch another Fletch movie unless it had John Hamm in it. So I don't have any attention. And, you know, it was a okay enough watch. So, yeah, you don't have to be a Fletchitarian, suffice to say. The next two I liked much more. And these two I would strongly recommend to people. Or strongly, maybe. We'll see. One is Athena. Athena! 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 Athena is on Netflix. Right. It popped up toward the end of September. It's the only movie of any in the last 3 months, maybe, definitely the last 2 months, that made my top 10. So it is a movie I would strongly recommend.
It's set in France. I think it's in like a sort of French Algerian community, and riots.
Class conflict, riots, yeah. Police brutality. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The director, who I'm not so familiar with, I think he comes from sort of the, you can tell he kind of comes from the music, like he's making music videos in the past.
Yeah, he did a lot of music videos, and his dad is like a very famous Greek director, Kostas Gavras, well-known director from like, I want to say the 70s and 80s.
Okay, yeah. So his son, Romain Gavras, really distinct style, which I'll get into, and I thought the style was incredible. Remember last year, I want to say South American director who's made Spencer, and then he previously made the one about Jackie.
Yeah.
So he made another movie that came out last year, which I was pumping a lot and saying I liked. Oh, yeah. I remember, I saw that,
and I liked it too. What was it called?
The most stylistic parts of that movie are a taste of what you're getting in Athena.
Chilean movie was Emma, just E-M-A.
Athena basically comes from, as you said, the son of this guy known for very stylistic movies. And then it's written by Laj Lai, Les Miserables, which I caught up with after seeing Athena. The two of them really have to be seen together. Les Miserables has none of the sort of epic style of Athena. It's more of a traditional, there are two or three kind of white or so cops go into this poor African migrant community in the slums of Paris. And then it's about how the sort of community, and particularly the kids, the teenagers, one of whom was brutalized by the police, how the teenagers sort of get revenge. That's the setting of Les Miserables. Athena is basically what happens right afterwards. Now, formally, like there's no actual connection, but the setting of Athena is that a kid has been killed by the police, not just brutalized like in Les Mis, but a young African migrant has been murdered by the police. It was caught on camera. The video went viral. And therefore now like the teenage gangs, the African teenage gangs of that neighborhood are out for revenge against the police. Athena is a rebellion movie. And it's not a one-shot movie, but most of the scenes in the movie are one shot. So there'll be like 20-minute scenes, which are all, or even longer, there'll be like 30-minute scenes, which are all caught by zooming drone shots. And then it like, you know, right up in front of people's faces. And there's a ton of use of kind of pounding drums and lots of like, you know, Molotov cocktails being thrown at the police, and a lot of like if you're at like a rave party and like people are waving like, you know, bright colors in the darkness, that's like kind of the feel of Athena. It's like it's a pumping, throbbing, in your face, angry, and it really, the style really captures the anger that it's portraying. It's so kinetic. Athena's so kinetic. I mean, a lot of critics have been like loving the first 10 minutes, and I would say it's not just the first 10 minutes. The first, you know, at some point maybe the style kind of the problem with the movie is the characters are not particularly good, and the politics are not particularly kind of deep. They're very high. They're very just light. So the longer you watch the movie, it's kind of maybe harder to connect with the characters because the characters are just symbols. But the overpowering anger and then just the style are so special in Athena that it's such a powerful movie just to watch. And for the first half an hour, you'll be like, oh wow, this is maybe the best movie I've seen in my life. And then, you know, after it's over, you'll be like, oh wow, that was really interesting and fun. But like the style for the first half an hour is like, wow. You know, I would say try to watch it on a big screen. You know, this isn't a movie to watch at work. And after you watch Athena, you'll want to go watch Les Miserables like I did, because the two really, I liked Athena more, even though I think Les Miserables is like the more mature, because Les Miserables, you know, it has like complex characters and it has a lot more talking and conversation. Athena, there's not much conversation. Kinetic, crazy action. The same way we sort of said at Ballard this year that like, wow, why doesn't, you know, Hollywood film action scenes like this? I think Athena is going to influence a lot of people. A movie that just came out in the very like first day or so of November. And that's Weird. Weird is the Weird Al Yankovic biopic.
The first time I heard Weird Al, probably when I was like 8 or 9 or 10 years old or so. I was just like, oh my God, this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. Oh my God.
Which of his songs come to your mind? You say, okay, Weird Al Yankovic.
Like, which song? Eat It. How come you're always such a fussy young man? Don't want no Captain Crunch, don't want no Raisin Bran. Well, don't you know that other kids are starving in Japan? So eat it. The Amish Paradise.
Yeah.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity. Man of the land, I'm into discipline. Got a Bible in my hand and a beard on my chin. But if I finish all of my chores and you finish thine, then tonight we're gonna party like it's 1699. We've been spending most our lives living in an Amish.
Eat It and Amish Paradise are probably two most prominent songs, I guess. And both
of
them.
Oh, the Flintstones one? That's the Red Hot Chili Peppers riff.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Weird Al Yankovic is a parody, as John's saying. He's a parody writer, meaning he takes famous songs and he just like puts in ridiculous, often about food, ridiculous like language. And he has like a very unique voice. He doesn't have a very good voice. I don't know what's considered a great singing voice, but like he has like a raspy, just kind of voice. Yeah. And yet he just has so much fun with these lyrics and then this music. So I would say the Michael Jackson take on Beat It and then the Amish Paradise, those are his two most prominent ones that are really like, they have a lot of fun with them. They have a lot of fun with them, like, you know, this in the movie. And then also, My Bologna, if I'm butchering bologna, like My Bologna, like My Sirona. That was, I think, I mean, the way the movie portrays it, that was his first song. And I think that was one of his earliest songs. It might have been his first hit. So that one I was also a bit familiar with. Anyways, the bit to understand about, so do you know the background for this movie? Had you heard anything about it?
I mean, I know Daniel Radcliffe plays Weird Al.
Oh, so I have to tell you some of the, I have to tell you the background then, because I had seen this background, but I didn't know this was the movie. And the story then is really fun, which is in 2012, in response to, in 2012, what were some of the musical biopics? There was the Johnny Cash one that had come out. And then there's a few music biopics that came out in 2010 and 11. And so in response to those in 2012, The Funny or Die, which is kind of like Key and Peele, the Funny or Die YouTube channel, at the time, they made, just as part of their skits, they made a fake trailer for a Weird Al biopic that was making fun of the movies at the time about Johnny Cash. And they cast Aaron Paul, you know, Aaron Paul, fairly well known.
Yeah, Breaking Bad.
Olivia Wilde, Pat Oswalt, and a lot of like kind of, you know, comedians making cameos. In this, and it's on YouTube to this day. I'll put the link in the notes. It's a 2-minute trailer for a Weird Al biopic movie directed by one of the Funny or Die writers at the time called Eric Apple. And it's a really, really fun trailer. And it's very much, again, it's Funny or Die. It's very much making fun of the idea of music biopics. You know, it's like Weird Al is like 5 years old and he's like wearing a Hawaiian shirt and his parents are like, no, Weird Al, like you can't follow your dreams. Life is only successful if you're normal. And he's like, no, I want to be weird. You know, and then it's like all these like overly hyped up bizarre scenes where it's like Madonna is like being like, oh, Weird Al, I love you so much. Like, let's make love right now. And, you know, it's like, it's really actually fun. Aaron Paul is great in it. He has this bizarre mustache. Aaron Paul is really fun. So that was a fake trailer. It came out 10 years ago. And then apparently what happened is that Al Yankovic, who has never stopped going on tour, he shows that trailer while he's like changing costumes at all of his live shows. And so that fake trailer has become this, you know, this super popular part of his live shows. And so hardcore Yankovic fans, which neither one of us clearly are, have been clamoring for a movie to be made based on this fake trailer. And they've been clamoring and asking for it year after year. And he always was like, no, no one cares. Like, biopics are dead. And then what happened in the last few years?
They went bananas. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what have we had? We had the Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, there was the Bohemian Rhapsody, and then, yeah, you know, Queen. Elvis was this year.
Yeah. What was the one before Bohemian? The Elton John. There was the Elton John one.
Oh, Rocket Man. Yeah, that was after, yeah. I think. But that's
what they say. So apparently, Weird Al called up Eric Apple, the guy who
had never made a movie before. You know, he's just a comedy skit writer,
and he's like, "Hey, he's like, now that Rocket Man and now that Bohemian Rhapsody are like in the culture, and he's like, I heard they're making about a movie about Elvis. My fans are always saying like that trailer you made should be made into a movie. Let's do it."
And oh, that's Eric funny. Was like, I did not know okay. this story.
Yeah. And so they went around Hollywood saying, hey, we want to make a parody music biopic about a real person, but like making fun of biopics, you know, in the style of like Airplane, like those kind of air Naked Gun.
Yeah.
Who I didn't realize. Apparently, Weird Al Yankovic is in all the Naked Gun movies. Anyways,
so they went around Hollywood. No one would give them money. Everyone was like, this is a terrible idea. You're a weirdo. Like, no one really likes your songs. He is a weirdo, obviously. Yeah, like, literally, the movie's called Weird. And finally, they got $8 million. I think it was, like, less. It was, like, a $6 million budget. It was filmed during, like, late stage, still corona phase. So, like, it was filmed very limited. Most of the roles in the movie are, like, comedians or like stand-up comedians who are all doing cameos, which are like Jack Black. They're really fun, and so you can tell like it was made on a very low budget, and you can tell that at times. And they tried actually originally to get like Aaron Paul and Olivia Wilde and Pat Oswalt just to come back and like take their roles, but for any number of reasons, some of those people couldn't come back into the movie. I think Aaron Paul is a cameo in the movie at some point. And so Daniel Radcliffe was picked instead. Now, Daniel Radcliffe, when you think of Weird Al Yankovic, I guess the first thing you think about is what? His hair? Like his look. When you think about his look, I don't know what comes to mind, if anything.
When you think of
Weird Al Yankovic, like what comes to mind in terms of his like physical appearance?
Like that he's curly hair.
Yeah, he has this like massive mane of hair. And then also he's really tall. I think he's like 6'5" really? Or something. Yeah, he's like a really tall guy. Like he's like a big dude.
I did not know that.
Daniel Radcliffe is like really small. And so
yeah, he is. Yeah.
Daniel Radcliffe really doesn't look anything like him. And yet this is kind of, so I have two things that I'll say about the movie and then I'll kind of leave it there, which is one of the things about all these biopics, you know, because they're all sort of like, again, bio movies, is that people have been like, oh, Bohemian Rhapsody wasn't very good, but we're going to give an Oscar to the lead because he's so transformative as the Queen frontman. And then Rocket Man, I remember people saying, look, Rocket Man, I didn't see either one of them. Rocket Man, people were like, oh, it's not so good, but he was so transformative as Elton John. So we're going to give, you know, an Oscar nomination or whatever it is. And Daniel Radcliffe is so good in this movie. He's really good. And but that said, this movie's also much more fun. I didn't see those two, but I had no motivation. I saw Elvis. This movie's much more fun than Elvis. Now, I don't want to get expectations up too high for this movie. This movie is kind of like Walk Hard / Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, but it's not as good as either one of those. Meaning the Nick Cage movie, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, is similar to this in that this is very much like winking at the screen as like, oh, we're making like a Weird Al movie about his life. And it's similar to Walk Hard in that it's very much, it's intentionally a parody of biopic movies. So, you know, I think Weird Al's, I just listened to a brief interview with him before we went on. And he said, he's like, yeah, my life is actually really boring. Like nothing's happened to me besides my ridiculous song career. And so in this movie, they give him all the sort of conventional arcs that we see in Walk Hard, the really funny biopic from 10 years ago, music biopic. And so they intentionally kind of like give Weird Al. So to touch on what you had said earlier, John, in this movie, one of the kind of really, this is one of the funnier things in this movie is that in the middle of the movie, Weird Al Yankovic, Daniel Radcliffe, decides he wants to be an original artist. He doesn't want to be a parody artist anymore. And so he releases a song called Eat It, which in the movie's context is an original movie. And then what happens is kind of one of the key moments of crisis is that Michael Jackson comes out with Beat It, and then Radcliffe loses it. He's like, I can't believe it. How can you parody someone else's music? Like, that's such a terrible thing to do. He's like, who is this Michael Jackson? He's just trying to like ride my coattails. And then the other friend, and the guy playing his agent is Weird Al. Weird Al plays like his agent. Right. His agent or whoever it is, not his agent, but like the movie producer or whatever. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, this is like what you've done your entire career. And he's like, what? I'm an original artist now. I don't do those things. And so that's one part. The other part is that Madonna, and I'll share this as well in the episode, maybe as the intro, Madonna is like a major part of this movie, and I'll share this in like in the at the intro to this this episode. Weird Al has been asked, because apparently if you go into Google these days and you type in Weird Al, the second most common like completion of that term in Google search is now Madonna. And so he was asked on like Jimmy Fallon or something, and he was like, hey, did you and Madonna really have like a romantic relationship? Because that's what like everyone is Googling. And right, Weird Al was he goes, look, the movie has about like 1% of truth, and then we just kind of stretched those truths out to make a story. He's like, I met Madonna once in 1985 for 30 seconds.
That's hilarious.
And then not only that, he's like, and then also her representative, he says, called me at one point and said, hey, we see that when you cover other artists' songs, they get a big bump. So can you cover Like a Virgin? And Madonna suggests maybe making a song called Like a Surgeon. Apparently Madonna came up with the parody of her own song. And so Weird Al's like, those are the only interactions I've had with her. But like in the movie, she's his love interest and she's sort of the bad guy. And, you know, she's his whole character. Evan Rachel Woods plays her and is really fun. And so that's kind of what I have to say about this movie, which is it's not great. It's kind of dumb comedy most of the time, but it's really fun. And Daniel Radcliffe, and there's a lot of cameos. A lot of the scenes are based on scenes from his songs / from like famous movies. So you're more of like a movie guy than I am, John, in terms of like classic movies, but like you'll probably notice like a lot of scenes are clear shout outs to like famous movies over the last 20 years. Like when he kind of makes it big and he's invited by his agent to the agent's pool party, that's the whole pool party scene. It's like a one shot where he walks into the mansion, into the pool, and there's all these like, you know, kind of, you know, singers or whatnot. They're all played by comedians kind of standing around the pool, and kind of, you know, that whole, you can probably know where that's coming from in terms of like a kind of a memorable one shot at a around a pool party in Hollywood. So, you know, there's a lot of, yeah, exactly. So it's like directly Boogie Nights inspired. And like even the lines are sort of Boogie Nights inspired, like just that one scene. So there's a lot of like, they're having just so much fun. It doesn't really make much sense. It gets like really zonky at times. It's very much kind of like a certain style of a Weird Al Yankovic song, right, which isn't for everyone. Like some people that it's not going to be particularly funny, but even if it's not particularly funny for you, I think just the cameos and the movie references or whatever it is, I think most people will really enjoy it. So I would recommend Weird Al. And then the last thing I'll say about it is that it's on Roku, which I don't know what Roku is, but I guess some of you may know what that means. The Weird Al Yankovic himself has encouraged people to, as he said, he used a lot of bad puns to basically say, go out and torrent the shit out of this movie if you want. So you could find the movie in, you know, various streaming channels if you have the interest in doing so. Or you can hit me up and I can share a copy of it as well.
Cool.
That's all I got for you. Yeah. So Athena, go out and watch on Netflix. Weird Al, go out and watch on French Netflix. And then, you know, John, take me home. Anything you saw in the last month or so that didn't come out this year, but you still were excited by?
I rewatched Interstellar, which was very fun. I hadn't seen that movie in a few years, mm-hmm. probably since like Tenet came out, which I think was my first mm-hmm. time on the podcast, mm-hmm. which is kind of funny. And I had rewatched 2001 A Space Odyssey mm-hmm. Not long before that. And it just got me thinking about Interstellar and some of the similarities between those movies. So I couldn't get it out of my head. I thought, well, I'm just going to watch it. And the movie holds up so well. I really, really love it. I think it's my favorite Christopher Nolan movie. And I don't really know what else to say about it, but it just was a delight to rewatch. And it's just a movie that I know that probably every few years from now until I'm not watching movies anymore, I'm going to fire up and get something really special out of. So that was a nice, tonic in the sea of otherwise just all disappointment in the movie world.
Yeah. I mean, like the last Nolan movie, you know, was kind of underwhelming for me, and he has an exciting one.
Last two for me.
Coming down the pipe. But, you know, Interstellar is just so ambitious that even if you don't really connect with it, I still think there's something that everyone can kind of dive into. For me, I don't know how many Mel Brooks movies you've seen, like the classic Mel Brooks movies from, what is it? I guess like mainly the 80s or the 70s. You've seen most of his catalog? Frankenstein or Spaceballs.
I've seen Young Frankenstein, Spaceballs, and I haven't seen like things like A History of the World or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. Maybe half of his movies I've seen, and the other half are unknown. So
I've seen most of them like years past. So while my wife and I were traveling, we were in Portugal in early October, and so obviously History of the World came up because, like, you know, there's that scene that even if you haven't seen the movie, you may have seen the clip. There's that kind of classic scene where he's making fun of the Inquisition. And when you're in Spain or Portugal, obviously the Inquisition is a lot of the history on display. And so I shared the Inquisition scene with my wife, and that kind of got me going, being like, oh, I want to like catch up with like classic Mel Brooks. If you remember like a few months ago in real life, I was trying to like catch up with 90s comedies. I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll go back a bit farther. You know, I always feel like comedies these days don't come out, and they're kind of a nice pick me up, as you said, a nice tonic when otherwise movies aren't working. So I try to like, you know, cover my missing gaps in comedies when I have some, you know, movie time. And there's a few of Mel Brooks I haven't seen. Most of them I have seen, though. Robin Hood Men in Tights is one of my favorite movies of all time. It probably is in my top 10, like all-time movies. I saw a ton as a kid, and, you know, just, and that to me still holds up. Spaceballs, like, goes only so far as you kind of care about Star Wars, I think. But I rewatched a few of them, but the one that really stayed in my mind is Blazing Saddles, which I think is considered one of his most, I think what, Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein, people are sort of are most into vis-a-vis Mel Brooks. Is that fair?
I think Young Frankenstein's number one. Blazing Saddles might be after that. It seems fair.
Yeah, but the two I think are kind of at the top of the pyramid vis-a-vis like his, when people talk about his like most of his best movies or whatnot. I didn't catch up with Young Frankenstein for another time yet, but Blazing Saddles I saw, and maybe this is the way at least I'll end this podcast for my part. It doesn't hold up. It is not funny at least for me, today's day and age. There's a few like limited scenes, like, you know, like when the black, so Blazing Saddles is like Mel Brooks comedy, which is Mel Brooks comedy was sort of just like throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. But the two scenes I had remembered going into it that I was excited to sort of see how they work in the context of the movie. One is a bit funny, but it's completely on its own, which is when the black sheriff kind of rides into the town and he's supposed to save the townsmen from the evil cattle herders or whatever, or the railroad people. But he's black and they're a bunch of racist, you know, white hicks. And so they're all excited to like greet him. And then when they see he's black, they're all like terribly disappointed. So like, that's still a bit, you know, humorous. But otherwise, you like, it's not a spoiler, I think, to say like the famous ending scene of Blazing Saddles, like when they all are just punching each other and then they kind of fall into like other lots on Hollywood. So then like they fall into like a Roman Colosseum movie, or they fall into like a lunchroom, and they're just like, it's just the entire end of the movie is just basically like a massive brawl where everyone is just like punching and kicking each other. And then they just kind of crash through like Hollywood sets. It just doesn't work. I don't know. Like the entire movie basically was very flat to me. It was very like potty humor. Obviously, you know, this was probably challenging at the time in the 70s when it came out, like no one had kind of maybe made jokes or racial jokes like that. But 30 plus years later, I don't think Blazing Saddles like deserves to be, you know, a comedy that holds up in today's day. Though I think you said this maybe at some time where you said like comedies can be very time specific, like they capture a mood of a certain period, and therefore maybe it's almost unfair to ask a comedy that came out and was cutting edge in the 70s to be as biting in 2022.
I'm sorry that you didn't have as good an experience with that. I haven't watched that movie in a really long time, and hard to say I would react, but
Well, that's what I got. You know, I'm not going to do what we have done in past months or we did last year and say more is good to come down the pike. You know, I'm going to, as we said at the top of this episode, I'm going to check out, like you, I think, some of the, you know, some of the movies on the November, December, you know, weeks ahead sort of catch my eye. But I'm not gonna push it. Like I come back to sort of what your experience, which is if you sit down and if something like isn't working for you, then job is to engage you. It's not your job to engage the content.
That's exactly right.
You know, this has always been a
we're excited to get together and talk about movies, but there's a lot of movies that are excited to talk about. You know, I'm happy to talk to you, John, but like, we don't have a podcast to do, because if there aren't movies that we're excited to talk to each other about, then this podcast doesn't really need to exist. If there aren't movies there that motivate us to, you know, wake up early or go to sleep late or whatever it is to talk to someone about, then we don't need another movie podcast in the ether. Just like, we're not trying to hit any goals. We're not trying to monetize. Content has to drive this conversation into existence. And to the extent it barely did this month, thanks to maybe, you know, Athena or Weird Al, we'll see if it's up to snuff.
I suspect things will turn around a little bit.
Let's see for November, and you know, we'll speak then.
All right, sounds great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, John, catch you later.
Well, I had 2 weeks of vacation time coming after working all year down at Big Roy's Heating and Plumbing. So one night when my family and I were gathered round the dinner table, I said, kids, if you could go anywhere in this great big world now, where'd you like to go to? They said, Dad, we want to see the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. They picked the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. So the very next day we loaded up the car with potato skins and pickled wieners, crossword puzzles, Spider-Man comics, and Mama's homemade rhubarb pie. Pulled out of the driveway and the neighbors, they all waved goodbye. And so began our 3-day journey. We picked up a guy holding a sign that said Twine Ball or Bust. He smelled real bad and he said his name was Bernie. I put in a Slim Whitman tape, my wife put on a brand new hairnet. Kids were in the backseat, jumping up and down, yelling, are we there yet? And all of us were joined together in one common thought as we rolled down the long and winding interstate and off 53 to Soda. We're gonna see the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. We're heading for the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. Wait to get there, so we drove straight through for 3 whole days and nights. Of course, we stopped for more pickled wieners now and then. The scenery was just so pretty. Boy, I wish the kids could have seen it, but you can't see out of the side of the car because the windows are completely covered with the decals from all the places where we've already been. Like Elvis Orama, the Tupperware Museum, the Boll Weevil Monument, Cranberry World, the Shuffleboard Hall of Fame, Poodle Dog Rock, and the Mecca of Albino Squirrels. We've been to ghost towns, theme parks, wax museums, and a place where you can drive through the middle of a tree scene, alligator farms, and tarantula ranches, but there's still one thing we gotta see. Well, we crossed the state line about 6:39, and we saw the sign that said Twine Ball Exit 50 miles. Oh, the kids were so happy, they started singing 99 bottles of beer on the wall for the 27th time that day. So we pulled off the road at the Last Chance gas station, got a few more pickled wieners and a diet chocolate soda. On our way to see the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. We're gonna see the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. Finally, at 7:37 early Wednesday evening, as the sun was setting in the Minnesota sky, out in the distance on the horizon, it appeared to me like a vision before my unbelieving eyes. We parked the car and walked with awe-filled reverence toward that glorious, huge, majestic sphere. I was just so overwhelmed by its sheer immensity, had to pop myself a beer. Yes, on these hallowed grounds, open 10 to 8 on weekdays, in a little shrine under a makeshift pagoda, there sits the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. I tell you, it's the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. String. beside it, and I warned the kids, now you better not touch it, those ropes are there for a reason. I said, maybe if you're good, I'll tie it to the back of our car, and we can take it home, but I was only teasing. Then we went to the gift shop and stood in line, bought a souvenir miniature ball of twine, some window decals, and anything else they'd sell us. And I bought a couple postcards, greetings from the twine ball, wish you were here, won't the folks back home be jealous. I gave her camera to Bernie and we stood by the ball, and we all gathered round and said cheese. Then Bernie ran away with my brand new Instamatic, but at least we got our memories. So we all just stared at the ball for a while, and my eyes got moist, but I said with a smile, kids, this here's what America's all about. Then I started feeling kinda gooey inside, and I fell on my knees and I cried and cried, and that's when those security guards threw us out. You know, I bet if we unraveled that sucker, it'd roll all the way down to Fargo, North Dakota. Said, folks, I can tell you're all sad to go. Then I winked my eye and I said, you know, I got a funny kind of feeling we'll be coming back again next year. 'Cause I've been all around this great big